atheists, agnostics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
The government, hug the government, love. The government, hug the government, love. The government, hug the government, love.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Northern Kentucky University political scientist Michael Baranowski. Before we get to today's episode, I want to let you know about a new podcast I'm part of, Sustainable Planet. It's a podcast about, well, you can probably guess, sustainability, with a focus on rational and open-minded discussion of sustainability and environmental issues. The creator of the show is Kimberly Weir. She's a political scientist like me, but she also happens to be my spouse. And I know for a fact that Kimberly knows a lot about sustainability. She's taught multiple classes on it, and she has a passion for this stuff that's really impressive, especially because she doesn't let her passion cloud her judgment or close her off to different ways of looking at sustainability issues. And there are a ton of sustainability issues. You've got consumerism, recycling, food waste, agriculture, fair trade, organics, clean energy, resource depletion, plastics, transportation, carbon footprints, climate shadows, so much stuff. And while Kimberly and I agree on the importance of sustainability, we have plenty of differences in how we approach these issues and some of the conclusions we reach. I think it all makes for an informative and entertaining podcast, and I hope you do too. The first episodes drop on April 18th, just in time for Earth Day, and we'll be putting out a new episode every week after that. To check it out, search for Sustainable Planet on your podcast app or go to splanetpod.com. That's S-P-L-A-N-E-T-P-O-D, one word, .com. Thanks. And now, on to the midweek episode. I'm joined today by my conservative counterpart, Clevelandary attorney and defender of freedom, Jay Carson.
Hey, good morning, Mike.
Hey, Jay. So we just had a very slightly extended and I thought very enjoyable.
That was weekend. A good conversation. Yeah.
Good stuff. A few things lasted a little bit long, but that's a nice thing. We can go, we can expand and contract, usually expand to kind of fit what we have to do. But as always, there were some things that we didn't get to that I am looking forward to talking with you about. And one of those is something we actually haven't talked about in a while now.
What's that?
That's gun regulation. Not too long ago, the Biden administration announced a regulation that would close what's often called the gun show loophole. And that's, for folks who don't know, allows people to sell firearms outside of basically brick and mortar gun stores without running background checks on the people who want to buy them. And This new rule or new rules, which would take effect in 30 days because they're final rules, assuming there are, of course, no legal challenges that result in some nationwide injunction by some, you know, wild judge. But these rules explicitly list the type of gun selling activity that would require a seller to be a federally licensed gun dealer and therefore have to conduct background checks. Now, this would include, these rules do include exceptions for people who are selling weapons, firearms from their personal collections, as well as people who are selling guns that they've inherited. And according to the Department of Justice, there are over 80,000 licensed gun dealers in the U.S., but over 20,000 unlicensed sellers who apparently are regularly selling weapons through online ads, through gun shows, things like that, where they don't have to do checks. And the ATF estimates that around 22% of American gun owners have gotten their weapon without a background check. And once these final, well, when these final rules were announced, Attorney General Garland said, under this regulation, it will not matter if guns are sold on the internet, at a gun show, or at a brick and mortar store. If you sell guns predominantly to earn a profit, you must be licensed and you must conduct background checks. This regulation is a historic step in the Justice Department's fight against gun violence. It will save lives. What do you think, Jay?
Nah, I'm sort of lukewarm, and I've always sort of believed that the whole gun show loophole was sort of a red herring, right? I think, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but in so many of the shootings or crimes you hear about, rarely if ever is it traced back to, well, it was a gun show loophole sale. That said, I think you'd be balanced the restrictions that you're putting on private people who may be selling, again, private collector's pieces, that sort of thing, versus the people who are in doing commercial sales, right? And that's just a line that the government draws at some sort of arbitrary point, and you hope it's not too arbitrary. I think the exceptions here make sense. What I'm saying is I think this is a largely symbolic move in any event. So I don't see it to have a whole lot of...
Well, to be fair, Garland said it will save lives. You didn't say how many, right?
To me, it's also a little weird of like, look, if this was, I would have thought this might have been something that the administration would have done on, you know, one of these day one executive orders.
It does seem pretty straightforward, because also I think, as you, I think, alluded to, at least there's in a way a market based, almost conservative case to be made for this, because it essentially creates even playing field, right? If you don't, you shouldn't get special treatment just because you're selling your guns online.
Right. So people who go through all the hassle they need to go through to get an FFL, shouldn't be undercut by people who are essentially commercial sellers, who don't have to go through the same restrictions.
And in a lot of cases, and this is true for some government regulations, certainly, that they can be really burdensome on small businesses, but this, or on just the individuals involved in the transaction, this really isn't the case. I mean, I was curious about
it used to be, and that's why it's different now, because of technology, right?
Exactly.
Talked about background, when we had background checks and these sort of things put in the 90s, that the technology to do that at a gun show just wasn't there or wasn't easy.
Yeah.
And now it is.
Yeah. And now, I mean, I was curious about the very nuts and bolts, and there's this form 4473, the firearms transaction record. You have to fill this out when you're dealing with a federal firearms dealer. It's like 3 pages or so. It probably would have taken me like under 10 minutes, certainly, to fill out. And then you fill that out, the dealer sends in the thing to the instant criminal background check system. Usually it takes a minute or two. And also the law is that if for whatever reason, a determination on whether or not it's okay to sell to this person can't be made within 3 business days, you can legally complete the transfer. So in the vast majority of cases, this is not, as it is with some things, a substantial regulatory burden, basically. Right. So, but yeah, I feel like this is a reasonable, I hate the word common sense, but I'll say, you know, pretty straightforward sort of thing that, yeah, I guess I'm wondering too, why the administration maybe didn't do this. Well, they had other things going on.
Well, I could float a theory.
Yeah.
Right. And one is that they've loved flogging the gun show loophole for forever. Right. And now Biden feels like he really needs to do something.
And this is something. Sure.
Now that is so it's sort of like, all right, well, I'm going to close the gun show loophole that I've been complaining about for years and years and demanding Congress do something about it, because the gun show loophole is, and which again, to me, the gun show loophole is sort of plays a minimal part in firearm regulation. And yeah, like Garland said, well, it'll save lives. Well, maybe I'm not real sure on that. I think for gun control, gun rights purists, I think the argument is that, look, they don't want to be subject to any regulation or any sort of government tracking of their purchases. And I understand that from a philosophical point, but from a practical matter, that ship has sailed.
I almost would want to see this introduced in Congress as something like the Community Gun Shop Protection Act of 2024 or something like
that. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, because that, you know, obviously, but anyway, so, but yeah, I think we largely agree on this, is that, you know, other things being equal, I can see where the benefits outweigh the costs on this, pretty straightforward thing. And so yeah, now I want to move from this to a different kind of regulation that maybe we'll have a little more difference on. Okay. So, yeah, I don't know if you're a table saw guy. Is there something?
I'm not really. I did not do well in shop.
Okay. Well, I very much, I mean, My dad, as you know, my dad was a contractor. He owned his own business. I have spent a lot of time around table saws. I mean, as a little kid in his shop, and working for him. I worked for my cousin, who's also a carpenter, table saws on a job site. And so one thing I learned about table saws is table saws are dangerous. In fact, one of the things my cousin taught me, who liked to play interesting little practical jokes, is I didn't know that table saws could kick back wood on you. And he designed a little experiment unbeknownst to me where I got a big piece of wood kicked back on me because that was the way we did things back in the day. Anyway, so I emerged bruised and everyone else had a good laugh at my expense, but they can be pretty dangerous, right? And I didn't really appreciate how dangerous they could be until very recently when I saw some data on table saw related injuries. They result in somewhere around like over 4,200 amputations per year. And that is more than 16% more than all of the other amputation injuries tracked by the Consumer Product Safety Commission combined. So, I mean, these things are cutting off fingers left and right here, right? And now there was an attempt to mitigate this. Back in 2010, the power tool industry, the people who made table saws said, well, we will agree to these voluntary standards about blade guards. And this is a common thing that industry does when they're worried about being regulated. They say, well, hey, we'll self-regulate. Don't worry about it. But the problem with these blade guards, and those of you who use table saws will know what I'm talking about, is they guard the blade, but they also, therefore, make it really harder to see your cut line. And so almost everyone I know, the first thing they do when they get a table saw is they take the blade guard off because it makes the table saw much less useful. And so, of course, that not surprising, since this standard has gone into effect, we've seen no reduction in table saw injuries because people just take them off, right? But there's a better way. Over 20 years ago, there was a technology that was developed that basically can tell when flesh, any kind of flesh, is almost in contact with a blade through like an electric current, and it almost instantaneously will stop the blade, turning, you know, what could have been an amputation into what maybe a minor nick sort of thing. And there's only one company, SawStop, that sells a table saw that has this. And because it has a key patent behind the technology, other companies haven't been able to offer their own version. But of course, this comes at a price. These saws are something like a couple hundred dollars more for a basic comparable model. So now the CPSC has said, well, maybe we want to do something about this. They proposed a rule that would make saw stop like brakes on these blades mandatory in all new table saws sold in the US. And SawStop has said, we will allow our technology to be publicly used. Yeah, this is a good thing. We're all for this.
Well, of course they will.
Right. Well, they'll help them.
When
as
you
well.
Say publicly used, whoever's using it would obviously pay them a license.
Well, they said they would put this into the public domain, basically. So they would not they would release their patent, this patent, into the public. So no, they would not get a licensing fee for this.
Right.
And according to the government's analysis, the net societal benefit for these new rules would be roughly $3,000 for each new table saw sold. And this takes into account medical bills, lost income, also pain and suffering. This benefit compares to an increased cost of between $338 to $1,210 for each new saw, the new safer saws. But even if you want to zero out the cost of pain and suffering, the societal benefit still amounts to an average of $900 per saw sold. So the cost benefit suggests that, well, this is going to lead to a lot less costly and painful finger amputations and ER visits. And this is going to be a net benefit. And honestly, again, for me, I'm a regular power tool user. I'm the son of a carpenter who had a mangled finger because this technology didn't exist in his day. I think this is a good proposed regulation. Jay, what do you think?
You know, I look at this and there's always this thing on the left of anything that is salutary or seems salutary must be made mandatory. And I guess that's my problem is, if this is such a good idea, why does the government have to dictate it? If they're going to offer this, the patent for free, and other companies can use it for free, why wouldn't they just do that? And it would be in their interest to do so, because they're selling a safer saw, which presumably more people would want to buy, as opposed to, I mean, no one advertises as the, look, we're the more dangerous saw.
There's the flaw in your logic right there. The flaw in your logic is that people we know underestimate their ability to avoid injury. Because for the most part, if in my dad's daily life as a carpenter, he made an average hundreds of cuts probably every day with a table saw, or at least, you know, maybe 100 cuts. I don't know, depending on the kind of job we were working on. And in almost all those cases, 99% you know, even thousands of cases, there wasn't a problem, right? And that's the thing. It's with repeated usage. And so this isn't, people might think, well,
right. It's the percentage, right?
Right.
You're more likely to get injured.
This isn't necessarily geared toward the casual user who will occasionally use a table saw. It's, you know, and I've had this happen. You're rushing to finish a job because you have some jobs that are piled up and you've got this other job on Friday. You got to get the cabinets made or what have you, the wood cut. And so you're pushing through, you're tired. It's the end of the day. Someone calls out your name right in the middle of a cut. You turn, and that's all it takes. And that's, people underestimate how likely that is to happen because they don't understand the probability over a large number of incidents. So even if those other table saws are 99.9% safe, well, if you have, you know, 10,000 cuts you're making, that means you're going to end up getting mangled at some point.
We hope you enjoyed this preview of our supporters exclusive midweek show. If you'd like to hear the rest of the episode, we hope you'll consider becoming a supporter. Supporters get ad-free access to all of our shows, membership in our Politics Guys Discord group where you can join in on the conversation, and other benefits at different levels of support. To become a supporter, go to patreon.com/politicsguys. You can also support us through Venmo, we're at Politics Guys, or through PayPal. You'll find all of our support links in the show notes, as well as at politicsguys.com/support. And if you'd like to get the midweek show, but you're not in a position to become a financial supporter, that's not a problem. Just send me an email at mike@politicsguys.com, and I'll be happy to get that set up for you.
This podcast is part of the Democracy Group.